Tim to be our speaker this evening because he was supposed to speak at his meeting on the mainland he was sharing last week. So I asked him if he would share for us on Christmas and share his story for 15 or 20 minutes and pick a topic for us after.
Okay, great. Thank you. Aloha to my Hawaiian AA family. I'm so glad that you guys are here on Christmas, and I'll try to speak as loud enough for the guys back there to hear me. Can y'all hear me okay?
Oh, yeah, we got you.
Okay, good. I told you I was from Atlanta, Georgia. I actually live in Gainesville, Georgia, but my home group is at the NABA Club in Atlanta, and that's the Northside Alcoholic Benevolent Association. It's a clubhouse. It was built about 65 years ago, way before I got sober. I got sober April 30th, 2007. I was born December 30th, 1953, so I was 53 years old when I picked up my first white chip, and thank God it's my only white chip. But I'd never been to an AA meeting, and it was my life's mission never to darken the doors of AA. I really went out of my way. I had many opportunities, a lot of invitations, a lot of suggestions. Court-ordered psychologist thought it might be a good idea, but I figured out how to blackmail him. Got him to sign a letter that I wrote for him under his name that I was cured of alcoholism. That did not satisfy my probation officer, but he protested. He called the doctor and said, "There's no way Tim Ridgway is cured of alcoholism." And he said, "I'm the doctor. If I say he's cured, he's cured." Obviously, the doctor never read the big book or the doctor's opinion, and I hadn't. Probation officer, he warned me. He said, Man, I've had people like you before, and I see you again. It's not going to go well. But he let me have my driver's license back, which is a good thing, because for about 7 months, I drove without a license in Atlanta, Georgia, a city of almost 3 million people. A lot of crazy drivers. I would drive to the probation officer. I could have gotten sober then. It would have been a great opportunity, but I had to wait 25 more years of being, you know, controlling my drinking, going on the wagon periodically, because I could always stop drinking if I had a good enough reason, except for the last time. The last time I got 14 months, and it was Thanksgiving Day, put the bottle down. And then following Thanksgiving, I never did announce that I wasn't drinking, but my family could tell that I wasn't. And they asked me, "When was the last time you had a drink?" I said, "Last Thanksgiving." And they said, so they went out and got me a one-year medallion from AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. Never been to an AA meeting. And I know they meant well. I didn't know anything about rigorous honesty, but I just figured it was kind of a sacrilege to carry a one-year AA medallion. And then things happened. Next couple of months, I gave myself permission to have a glass of wine with dinner. And I drank like a gentleman. I didn't finish it. And the next week, all I thought about was when I was going to have the next glass of red wine. So I went, and I finished that glass. And then the next week after that, I said, "What the hell?" And I just pulled up to the liquor store, and I restocked my bar, packed the cooler, iced it all down. I was out in my bass boat, I live on Lake Lanier, and with the extra money of not drinking, I was able to afford to buy, with just pocket money, a used bass boat. I was out in that bass boat before I started drinking, and it was just so boring. I was like, "Hey." And my son, he loves to fish, but really, at that point, we weren't that close. And he really didn't want to be on a boat with me. When I gave myself permission to have that wine, I decided I could put a cooler beer in the boat. Next thing I knew, I'm driving, you know, about 30 knots, standing up, holding a ski rope to the accelerator and the steering wheel like I'm on a surfboard, talking on a cell phone at the same time, and managed to light a pipe, you know, with all that going on. And I did notice the warning that I was heading into the shallows of the Chattahoochee River where it feeds into Lake Lanier. And I hit a sandbar going at that high rate of speed. I beached it, and I was beached it really good. I picked up a staff. It was just floating in the water, but it was a nice, firm piece of wood, and it was about 12 feet long. And I was just going to use it around the shore if I ever got around to fishing, like a gondola pole. I couldn't budge the boat, so I put the gondola pole down, and I pushed it, and I could see I made about a half-inch progress with each tug. So 11 hours later, I got off the sandbar, and I only had two beers in the cooler the whole time, and I didn't touch any of them, because I knew if I had them, and then no beer, I was going to go start raving mad. My priority was to get off that sandbar, get the boat back to the dock, get to the car, and get to the liquor store before they close. One of the liquor stores, a little 7-Eleven up down the street. And I got there like 2 minutes after midnight, and they said, no, you're too late. And I already had it in my hand. I had my money in hand. I just threw it on the counter, ran out the door with the booze. And then I was too afraid to go back, you know, to face those people for a long time. But then I found myself floating one day. I had a life jacket on. The dog was in the boat with me. And I was just floating. I look over, and there's a beer can floating next to me. And I was like, boy, if I do that again, I have to stop drinking. The next day, I did the same thing. So I didn't make any decisions that next morning, but my sister came by. She came. I didn't know she was coming by. And she just said, no, I just wanted to stop in and see how you're doing. And so I was acting kind of quirky and weird, and she was just like checking on me. And I said, I'm not doing too good. She goes, well, why not? I said, I can't stop drinking. She goes, we just gave you that chip about 4 months ago. We didn't know you were drinking. I said, yeah, I've been sneaking around. But this time I can't control it at all. And I just keep doing stuff, crazy stuff. She goes, I know exactly what we need to do. You're going to come to town with me, and we're going to go to the NABA club. I said, what's a NABA club? I said, you'll see. Just pack your little case. So I packed the case. She said, you're not going to be coming back here for a while. And I really thought I was heading to like Betty Ford's or, you know, some kind of treatment. She walked me into my very first meeting, and it was the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA club. And the speaker was sitting right in front of me before he was introduced, and he had a nice jacket on, good haircut, good looking guy. I was like, wow, he looks pretty good. And I looked around, and there's a room full of people that all wanted to be there. And I didn't know about Happy, Joyous, and Free, but it sure looked like people were happy, joyous, and free. And he gets up and he starts talking, introduces himself. And I don't recognize him at first, but then he starts talking about the treehouse in his neighborhood when he was in ninth grade. And he would get all the alcohol and drugs delivered by his big sister's boyfriend on Friday afternoon for him and his little buddies. And I was the bootlegger and dope dealer for this guy. I didn't know that people said that sooner or later you'll hear your story sometime in the room, and the light bulb will go on. But he's sitting there, and he's talking about me for just a moment. I mean, he didn't dwell on me. He didn't even know I was in the room. But he did recognize me when I jumped up to grab a white chip. I mean, I figured if this happens my very first meeting, I better get in, whatever, sign up for whatever it was. I didn't know what to do, so just be willing. And then I met my sponsor. Didn't know he was going to be my sponsor, but he handed me a big book. And he said, listen, when you go home tonight, get on your knees and pray to your higher power. Just keep it simple. I'm going, I've been praying. It don't work anymore. You just take the book home, get on your knees, pray, get in bed, open the book. I opened that book after getting on my knees and praying, and I read about a paragraph and nodded out with that book on my chest. And I don't know if it's through osmosis, but when I woke up, I felt something different. And I didn't feel like having a dream. But I did feel like getting on my knees and thanking that my higher power for the strength not to drink that night. And it was the first time I'd broken that cycle. Not just weeks, months. At the speaker meeting, they needed somebody to record the speakers. I had a journalism background, which is not the same thing, but I was willing to try. I had a background in computers, and I said, what the heck, I'll try. And so I screwed it up every which way. I mean, you couldn't have done a worse job. But I just kept doing it, and I didn't drink. And so, gradually over the years, over the months at first, actually, we do a pretty good job of doing that. And now we have a website. It's called aabluechipspeakers.org. There's some really good stories on there. All of them are really good stories, but some are really, really good stories. And I'm really glad that it's there. We had a fellow who was, he was a senior outbound representative of the CDC, which is close by to the club. His assignment was to eradicate polio from Africa. He told a story for me. I was like, man, he was full-blooded Indian, and he was a really bad alcoholic in his day. He gets in those jungles, and the chiefs like to, he has to go out and entertain some of the chiefs, and they got us some hooch that were just, it's really powerful and strong. And so he had had a couple of bouts where he had a slip here and there. He started listening to the new speakers, which inspired me to do it every week and do as good a job as possible. He was always on my mind when I was doing this thing, getting it started. And he's no longer with us now. He died sober. He was quite a guy. I didn't talk about my early life, but I can tell you that I started smoking after my father was killed. He was an Air Force pilot. I was going into second grade, and he was buried with honors in Vicksburg, Mississippi. The whole family was there in a flyover 21-gun salute, missing man formation. And it was really something. And I was like 6 and a half years old. My uncle, who was 14 at the time, he came up to me, he put his arm around me, and he told me I was a man of the house, and that I needed to take care of my mother and my little sister, which was really probably a good thing for him to tell me, but I felt like I had the weight of the world on me. I just, I didn't have any idea how I was supposed to do any of that. Watched TV, and Dick Van Dyke smoked Kent, Elliot Ness on Untouchable smoked Chesterfields. You got the Marlboro Man and all of this stuff. And my mother started smoking as a widow. Recessed filter Parliaments. And first started out smoking rabbit tobacco with my buddies out in the woods. And then I grabbed a couple of her cigarettes and brought them to the campfire. Learned how to inhale. And everybody else was like, just do it on a lark. And they were like, you know, you take a lot of hits on this, you know, when passing around. We didn't have the term Bogart, but I was, they say, you don't want to get addicted to this. And damn, if, you know, by the time I was in third grade, I was addicted. So I had to lie, cheat, and steal. Because you can't walk around 8 years old smoking openly, buying cigarettes, deciding to steal. Cigarette machines was 35 cents at that time. Watch and watch and make sure, you know, get away with it most of the time. Every once in a while, some guy would come out, you know, this little office building where it was just there, like some CPA or something, come out and say, "What are you doing, kid?" I said, "I'm getting these for my mom." And so, I mean, I just didn't tell the truth about anything. By the time I was, legally, okay to do something like that, and drinking, I just had developed being slippery, just not being honest. If it suited me, and sometimes just for the hell of it, just embellish, make stuff up. When I got my white chip at the Naval Club, I was going to meetings there like four times a day. They had meetings. I did a third step prayer with my sponsor, and at that time, y'all may have seen me riding bicycles around here. I was on a bicycle. That's all I had at that point. I lost all my cars. Sold my best boat. And still had my bike. So I went in really good shape. I got there, and there's a dining area in the club. And we had dinner, and then we went upstairs to do the third step prayer. And I got on our knees. And I hadn't stretched or done anything. I just rushed into the club after, like, riding, like, 6 miles on hills and stuff. And I had a leg cramp right in the middle of the prayer when I'm holding his hand. And I just peel over. And he's, like, wanting to let go of my hand. And I'm like, I got a firm grip on it. And he's going, "We don't have to do this. We just don't have to do this right now." And I'm going, I want. He's like, "Well..." I'm sure he still does third step prayer on his knees with his new sponsees, but I think he's careful about that these days. But this rigorous honesty, he told me to get started on my fourth step, and I just couldn't get started. If I had a couple of dollars in my pocket, that was pretty much it. That was about all I had at that point. Nobody trusted me with money. I'd put a dollar in the basket, and then I'd go down to what they call a quick trip. They had these roller hot dogs, and they were a dollar. And they had styrofoam containers. So styrofoam containers, I could put two wieners in the styrofoam container and pay for one hot dog. And the first time I did it was because I was hungry. The second time I did it was because I knew the secret to getting that extra wiener that I didn't deserve. I didn't make any progress. I couldn't get started on the fourth step. I wasn't part of the program. I was going to meetings. I was stealing hot dogs. And then I walk in one day, and they change from styrofoam containers to see-through containers. And there was no way to hide that second hot dog. I'd probably still be doing that today, making no progress. But God did for me, or quickly did for me, what I couldn't do for myself. And I put one in the bun, and I paid a dollar. I was pretty much on a hot dog diet. I mean, I was newly sober, and I was just, that's all I really had money for. I mean, at home, there were meals, but on the run, that was my go-to. So after about a week of that, I got on my knees to say the third step prayer, which I always had to read it out of the book. And after not stealing for a week, it just flowed out of me. And I said it, I looked up, and there was a light and a ceiling fan like this. And all of a sudden, I had this unearthly flash of light, and I had this connection that I never had, because really that was the first week since I was 8 years old that I was honest all week, and I had a conscious contact. And I wanted more of that because I got a buzz better than any drugs or alcohol or cigarette or anything I ever did from that connection. And I got a buzz like that right now. And I can get it every time I'm in an AA meeting, just about. Or any time I'm reading the literature or working with a sponsor. It's just a great program. So it's 7:32. And hopefully everybody's still sober and everybody will stay sober tonight.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. Topic, rigorous honesty. That might not be a good topic. Rigorous honesty.
Many thanks for sharing on rigorous honesty. Any other special note for Christmas?
Hi, my name is Sue, and I'm an alcoholic. And I have two little stories about that. This is a long time ago. I was asked to give a lead at a Saturday morning. And I guess, I don't know if this is the subject I started with, but I told the story in my lead. I told about having confiscated pens at work, when you're working and there are pens around. Sometimes I did it accidentally, but the day before I actually done this, I wanted that pen. and I told that myself. And what I remember about it is how shocked everybody was. I mean, I thought that was, it's not very serious. People were like, So I had to assess it differently and stop confiscating pills. Obviously, I wouldn't have talked about it if I thought it was that awful, but I needed to get it off my chest. The other thing is, about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now, I've had a state of being ill. Starting in September, I had a rough year. I lost a house in a hurricane and had to go through all the insurance mess, and then I had to sell the property, or at least try to. And it's been tough on me. It really has been rough. And I think my resistance to picking up bugs is probably down. So I've been pretty sick on and off since September, and I really get tired of it. And a little bit depressed about it, and feeling bummed, not thinking very, very well about it. Get into a few meetings, but not doing my work at home, really. And then I noticed that I was beginning to covet things that I saw in other people's yards. I this one purple pot in particular. I know that the lady who bought that is long gone. She sold this place and now it's a rental. And nobody appreciates that pot anymore. Nobody would know it. And then a couple of other items were appealing to me too. So I thought it was time to get in the book. Time to do a little bit more than just going to a few meetings. So I am. And I'm feeling better. And I'm not coveting the purple pot anymore. But stuff that I think of as fairly innocent, really isn't. Because it's not good for us. It isn't that it might do the world so much harm, but it harms us. That we need to be honest with us. And for our own sakes, because we feel so much better about ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Bill. Thank you for the great story. Actually, been in that club. Actually, in the planet.
Oh, great.
Nice. I'm sorry. Quite good reason. True story. The opposite. I suffer the opposite track of being rigorously honest is when I know that I go a little bit off the beam if someone even questions my honesty. Like, oh, did you see her this way or that? And my whole, you know, like, how do they know who they're talking about? And I, you know, like, how dare they question me? You know, and my, there's a little faith comes up once in a while. And I get great humor out of it. I'm like, you know, saying, why, something was missing. They're asking people, you know, I have that tinge of self-centeredness. Of course, they're talking about me. Who the fuck else are they talking about? You know, like, why not? But I really, really enjoy the practice of rigorous honesty because I was a transactional, apathetic alcoholic. Everything had a price. Everything was for a reason. Everything had a manipulation or anything. And when I'm honest, I can sleep at night, don't have to worry about who I said what to when and where, how ever it is. And I really, it's nice to hear that subject. It's nice to realize that that's where I need to be in practice to be. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shayla, the alcoholic.
Yeah.
Thank you for your share. It's been nice seeing you in meetings. And you said a few things that got my attention. One was you were talking about commitments. And those were so important for me when I was new. And I wasn't given the choice of taking commitments. I was just basically handed commitments. And, you know, it got me in meetings. And I so desperately wanted connection with something or somebody, I show up, you know. I'm too afraid not to. And rigorous honesty, God, that blew my mind when I really began to understand where it was. My sponsor used to tease me and say, you're going to have to learn a new way to communicate. Because I was incapable of telling the truth. It came very slowly. It came very, very slowly. It still does. And, you know, I'm really grateful we have this meeting today. I'm really grateful we're all here. My dad was a hope-to-die alcoholic, and he died when I was 9 months sober, 24 years ago on Christmas morning. And he just couldn't get this thing. You know, he could not get it. And I got to watch his trajectory into just oblivion, you know, absolute oblivion. And he tried cleanup and he couldn't get it. He did not want AA. And I'm just so grateful that I've had a different experience and that I've been able to suit up and show up for a while now. And I have a sober son. And, you know, I have another one that I'm saving a seat for. So stay tuned. But I'm just I'm really grateful to be here. Thank you for your share, and you know, thank you everybody else for sitting in their seat tonight. Thanks.
Good to hear, Sheila.
Thank you.
I'm Pat, I'm not calling. Thanks for your share. I love talking with your honesty. And you know, my thing was I was like a big manipulator or a game player, or at least so I thought until like my fourth or fifth inventory. But I was a big like liar to myself. And I've heard on several speakers these, and I should have just heard about another one that I was listening to like last week, that denial, the word denial is an acronym for don't even notice I am lying. And that's totally, you know, in the depths of my disease, that was totally me. Like, I couldn't even know. It was like I was lying to myself. I lied myself about things on a consistent basis, especially with people. Like, I would come up against, like, a deal breaker with somebody, like, in a, whatever, work relationship, something that I work for. More importantly, like, an intimate relationship, and I'd be like, it'll be all right. It'll be all right. And I tell myself some story about it's going to change, or I'll change, or fucking blah, blah, whatever. And it never did, you know. And then I was doing an inventory, and, you know, the topic of people-pleasing came up, and my sponsor was like, you know, there's a shorter word for people-pleasing. And I was like, really, what is it? He's all, it's called manipulation. Mm-hmm.
and I was like, oh shit, because I never saw myself like that. But it was so late, it was totally like that. You know, the big believer that I got to be honest, starting with myself before I could even hope to have any honesty with other people or in the world. My time in recovery has been quite a learning experience with that. Seeing the way that I, you know, was still in denial about certain things, and lying to myself about certain things, and not accepting certain things. And, you know, I've been having this health thing for the past couple of years. I just had this thing that happened over the past couple of months where I was like really unmotivated to go to work. I have like tons of work lined up. Money should not be an issue, except it's pretty physically challenging to do the work, but I make it more physically challenging in my head than it actually is. It's kind of digging my heels in. I just really don't want to go to this job. And then it causes this huge financial catastrophe. And I'm like, no, I am not living in reality. I am not being honest about what is really going on in my life. And as soon as I got really in touch with that and started to do things differently, like all of this power and ability like flowed in. And that has been my consistent experience in recovery. That when I follow the previous lettering on that point that we passed around tonight to my own self be true, and I'm really honestly being who I am, where I'm at in my life, like everything tends to flow pretty seamlessly. And when I dig my heels in and resist that, everything goes to fucking shit. And I've had to learn that lesson over and over in all different kinds of ways. You know, it's like a radical thing. God's over here, and it fucking pops up over here for me. And, you know, I've learned that anytime I'm telling myself a story about anything, whether it's an end of the world story or whether it's a story about, oh, this is going to be the best thing, like, it is trouble. It is totally trouble. I'm probably not being completely honest about it. And it's been really interesting to experience that and see life in a completely different way that I was completely incapable of even thinking about life in any of the words that I just used trying to communicate my experience. It was totally not even on the fucking radar. Except when other people did it to me, and then it was totally on the radar, and they were fucked up, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'm glad we're all good. That's all I know.
Hello, everyone. My name's Linda. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really glad that to me, Christmas is the day to hear it and to celebrate the birth of Christ. And that's in you for me where I can do for myself. I can do so. You said a lot of things that I kind of relate to. One of the things you said was, well, I gave myself permission to. And I used to do that too, but my disease progressed to the point where then I was drinking without my permission. And that's where it got me. And the rigorous honesty, I was thinking of, my whole drinking career. And have you been drinking? No. Or like, you go to the doctor. How much do you drink? And there's never, I haven't felt through. So, that was lying, cheating, stealing. That's what I'm doing. But what Matt was talking about, manipulation, I have to be really careful for that. Cash register on has been easy for me. But the manipulation is like lying by omission. And I just don't tell the whole, that one important fact there, that changes the whole personality without, because there's manipulation. And I got to be real careful for that. And, watch myself all the time. Anyway, thank you so much for sharing how we kind of hide that. I appreciate your look.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have time for a quick one.
I'm an alcoholic. I'm surrounded by thieves and liars. It's like a song from the 60s. Today has been, I've spent today feeling really grateful the whole day. The sun woke up, and so I got here. Just a little gratitude story. I'm really glad to be sober. Yes.
Amen. Thank you. In keeping with our seventh tradition, which states that we are self-supporting for our own contributions across the basket, and I've asked you to read our 12 traditions while we practice.
The 12 traditions talk about anonymous one, our commonwealth for receivers, personal recovery depends upon AA meetings. Two, for our group purposes, the one ultimate authority, and God is here to express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are respectful servants, they do not govern. Three, the only requirement for it is the desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, so in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, in the AA group, I never endorse, finance, and when the AA name is created, they're outside enterprise. The problems with money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, supporting outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. Ten, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles as part of our personalities.
Thank you, Sarah. If you don't have a home group, we welcome you to join our North Shore Aloha group. We have 4 meetings a week here in the Parish Hall, Monday through Wednesday. Also, if you don't have a big book, please talk to me, our lurch person, after the meeting. I'd like to thank our speaker, Tim. Our leaders, Jill and Sheila, and Tim and Michael for coffee and Seda.
Yeah, a moment of silence for the still suffering in and on this room, followed by a celebrated prayer.
God, grant us serenity to accept the things that cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Teach me how to do the work that you work at.
Thank you. Forget not how far that before. Remember.